Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever.
It's an unfair game.
They're schemers. Schemers trying to control their little worlds.
Rich get richer, that's the law of the land.
It's just money.
Blasphemy! This is madness!
I drink your milkshake!
Everybody, welcome back to Milkshakes, Markets, Madness. I'm here with Brent Johnson, the man behind the dollar milkshake theory. And if you're unfamiliar with that, well, please visit our YouTube channel at Milkshakes Pod, and you'll see there's a playlist that says start here. We'll take you down that rabbit hole. You know, all our videos are nicely organized into playlists, so you'll see different thumbnails for different types of segments we do. If you find a segment you enjoy, you can binge watch based on those playlists. This is going to be our full-length weekend recording. And let's see, Brent, we have something very important to discuss, which is this ongoing debate about de-dollarization, which is really kind of a zeitgeist that follows you around no matter where you go, particularly this week, because there was some research that you did based on the misunderstanding or how everyone was trying to interpret this bond holding chart of what China is actually holding, and that China is selling their bonds aggressively and so on and so forth. So I've kind of teed that up, but I feel like that in itself is going to be this massive conversation. So before we get there, it's kind of like a teaser. Everybody, we're going to talk about this. I mean, you posted this huge thread. It was very much a TLDR, too long, didn't read. And so we're going to do a EOTP, explain it on the podcast. But before we do that, let's talk markets. So let's just hand it off to you. Tell me what you thought about the market, and I can kind of lead us through some various topics, because it was all over the place for just about every sector.
Yeah, well, I think the biggest thing is that gold had a big move this week, right? And I continue to believe that it is on the back of the geopolitical concerns. But it's not just that. I mean, there's a lot. The whole world has kind of been on this razor's edge. We've talked about this all year, right? And we had talked about how gold held up really well all year despite the rise in real yields. And then we had talked a couple weeks ago about the fact that post the last Fed meeting, when Powell, you know, indicated there could still be more hikes down the road, that the market was starting to come to terms with higher for longer, or that the long end was going to have to catch up with the short end. And gold took about $100 pullback on that kind of outcome of that Fed meeting. And, you know, we even talked here about I was kind of getting excited to buy. And then we had all this conflict, you know, erupt in the Middle East again, and gold, you know, rallied back at the $100 that it lost. It gained that back pretty quickly, and then it put another 50 on top of it. And I think at one point on Friday, it was almost at 2,000. I think the futures actually did go above 2,000. I don't think spot did. And I think, you know, it closed around, 1985 or something like that. So, you know, we're right up against that $2,000 level again. I have never been a fan of buying gold on geopolitical concerns. So I'm glad I already own gold, so I don't have to go chase it. I still think that, you know, a few weeks down the road, a few months down the road, we're going to have a pullback in gold. The other thing I would say is, if this was really like a sustained move higher, I would have expected to see the miners explode higher this week, and they didn't. They were up a little bit. Maybe they were up a percent and a half, but I mean, that's not a big move for the miners. So I would have expected to see them up higher this week. The other thing is that, you know, I don't even know how many Fed speakers there were this week. And earlier in the week, they were, you know, I guess, for the most part, dovish, and equities kind of traded higher. Powell was, I kind of found him to be very neutral. I actually found him to be neutral to hawkish. I think a lot of people interpreted him as dovish. His prepared remarks, I guess, were dovish. But when he spoke, you know, to me, he made it clear that, you know, they still had work to do. They weren't done. November was a live meeting, and then with that, as well as the political conflicts, the geopolitical conflicts, you know, rising up for the rest of Thursday and Friday, you know, we had a sell-off into the end of the week. And so, And, you know, we talked about this last week. I said I thought that Tesla was going to have a big pullback, and that's exactly what happened. They missed on earnings. They guided lower, and, you know, I think Tesla was down 10, 15% this week, or no, probably more than that, maybe 20% this week, and I think it has further to go. So overall, now, you know, I think sometime in the next 24 to 48 hours, we're probably going to see some kind of an entry into Gaza by Israel. I pray to God it doesn't happen, but I think it probably will. And, you know, I think the markets will react to that. And where it goes from there is anybody's guess.
Right. So we did talk about last week's episode, which was entitled War and Gold. You know, just on the title itself, you can get a grasp of what we focused on. But you had emphasized this idea that some of the price move in gold was more or less a war premium, a response to the conflict. Generally, that doesn't last very long. You've kind of seen that response in other types of markets, but the slow reaction or less than enthusiastic reaction from the miners further kind of supports your hypothesis that this move is more war-driven and conflict-driven than actual, maybe more fundamentally driven around Fed policy and gold actually being able to finally break its tether with real rates. This is more of kind of a short-term bid because of the conflict. But at the same time, that all makes sense. And we did an entire episode on that last weekend. When we now look towards some of these other risk markets, although, you know, do we really consider the stock market, particularly the indexes, risk assets anymore, since they always seem to have an underlying bid. But when we're looking at equities and some of these other markets, and you're seeing the bond market, especially on the long end, 10-year, 30-year, all kind of kissed 5%. That became a big talking point. And then stocks pulled back a little bit. Are we seeing, how do you interpret this as, is any of that war premium related? Or are we just finally getting to the point, now that we're almost a year into doing this show, that things are finally getting exhausted? Is the animal spirit finally getting tired?
Well, you know, Powell kind of addressed this a little bit, and I think he kind of fumbled it a little bit, but he actually talked about the fact that, you know, we've been at this for a year and a half now. He addressed that there is a lag effect to hikes. He addressed that the fact that they kind of front-loaded this 18 months of Fed hikes was very much front-end loaded. I think it's been over a year since we had a 50% or a 50 basis point hike. You know, there've been a couple 25 basis points. And he indicated that we are now at a time where those the tightening that had already been done are probably going to start showing up. And so I think it's a combination of that. And I think it's a combination of the market just coming to terms with that even if the lag effects start to catch up to markets, that the Fed is not going to be in a big hurry to turn around and pivot and cut. Now, we've talked about this several times, that they will cut, they will pivot. If the market sells off, or if there's some kind of a risk-off event that causes them to come in to save the markets, then of course they will pivot. But barring a crisis, if we were to just go sideways in the S&P 500 for a year, or even down 10 or 15%, or 20, even 20% in the S&P 500 or the broad markets over the next 12 to 15 months, and if unemployment ticked up slowly, I don't think that would cause them to pivot. Now, again, if we have one of these knee-jerk, you know, elevator shaft drawdowns in the broad risk markets, and, you know, we have a liquidity crisis, then of course they will come in. But barring that, I don't think that they do. And I think that is kind of what the market is coming to terms with. And the other thing is, and I think this is a lower probability, but it's also the fact that they've got, quote unquote, gotten away with it for as long as they have, I think some people are saying, holy cow, you know, I don't think they're going to pull off the soft landing, but maybe that's a higher probability today than it was 18 months ago, right? And therefore, maybe long rates need to be higher. Or maybe it's also, you know, we've now got this, you know, geopolitical conflict, and we've got another war that we're maybe going to get involved in. And now we've got, you know, the conflict in Ukraine, we've got the conflict in the Middle East, you know, this whole thing in Taiwan and China has been brewing for years now. That's a possible third front that would potentially open. You know, wars are inflationary. And so maybe that's the long end saying, holy cow, you know, we've got these three geopolitical conflicts, that's inflationary. the U.S. government doesn't seem like they're going to stop spending money anytime soon. So that's a huge, the budget deficit's going to grow, you know, so therefore, you know, we'll still buy the treasuries, but we want to get paid more for them. And so, you know, that, and that, and that's, and I think that's partly the long end catching up with the front end loading that the Fed did.
Yeah. Interesting take on that. And it's a lot of the last 2 weeks has, you know, as far as bonds getting battered, has really come off of the budget debacle and then finally making an agreement. And I guess the market trying to digest how much the government is projecting to spend when clearly we're already running massive deficits. The war thing is funny. They're very much like proxy wars for us. We're not directly involved, but everyone knows we're directly involved. I didn't watch it, but you know, I guess Biden did some sort of address, you know, kind of speaking to the matters in the Middle East and asking Congress for another $100 billion to provide ammunition. It feels like, you know, on the topic of fatigue, if there's anything that's really fatiguing, it's certainly our balance sheet. And I think Americans just putting up with the endless and ruthless spending. This is kind of almost a tangent that maybe is better left for Madness. But I'm curious, at what point do you feel like we as Americans, as voters, have recourse to stop some of this if we really think it should end? I mean, do our votes really deter, you know, the government spending? It seems like that's not the case.
Well, so there's two parts to this. Is number one, everybody says they want the government to stop spending, but they don't want the government to stop spending in their hometown, right? They, you know, the whole, it's the whole not in my backyard. I mean, the reality is that we vote for these guys, right? These women, these men and women. And then, you know, the people that vote for them, they're the ones that are responsible for the mess we're in because they're the ones giving them the mandate to do it. I think there's two ways that this could be solved. One is everybody votes in a new candidate that's not part of Congress. And by God, somehow they get lucky. And this, it isn't a typical power hungry individual who wants to be a politician. The other way is just don't go to the polls. If nobody voted, they wouldn't have a mandate. If everybody literally stayed home on voting day, the government would collapse because there's, you know, but then the problem there is a strong man rolls in and says, okay, if you're not going to take a democratically elected system, then we'll give you our system. So there's no easy answer here, but you know, it's kind of the whole thing. It's kind of similar to the Fed. You know, everybody wants free markets until the markets crash and they need a bailout, right? You know, it's like there's no atheist in foxholes type of a thing, right? Everybody wants to be, you know, self-sufficient until they actually need some help. And so I don't really know if there is a good solution to it. As far as the spending goes with the wars, one way you do it is the protests. You know, is if enough people protest against a war, you know, the politicians have to listen. This is it. You know, when protests are basically many, not many as in small revolution, right? It's the people saying, we don't like the government policy. And if you don't change, we're going to keep coming here. And pretty soon we're going to start throwing things. And pretty soon we're going to carry pitchforks. And pretty soon we're going to carry torches. And, you know, if you don't change your policy, then we're going to change it for you type of a thing. And so, you know, but those are, you know, you can have the civil disobedience, you can have, you know, these demonstrations. But at the end of the day, you know, I think it's too entrenched. I think we have to go through the madness, right? I think we, you know, there's that, this is kind of maybe a horrible joke, but you've probably seen that cartoon where it's Piglet and Pooh Bear sitting on the stump and they're looking out at the scenery and they say, is this the day? Yeah, is this the day we burn it all down? And Pooh says, yeah, today's the day we burn it all down. And Little Piglet says, that's my favorite day.
Fair enough.
So I kind of feel like we need to go, listen, it's just, I kind of feel like it's cliche at this point, but this is like a fourth turning thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you need to go through it to get to the other side. And, you know, if you're in hell, keep going because eventually you'll get through it. And I feel like we just got to get through it. And I unfortunately think this is going to go on for, you know, not a couple more weeks or months, but years before we get through it. But listen, I would, there's nothing I would rather be wrong about than this. So,
well, yeah, I mean, that's something you've continually emphasize, certainly on this show, but anything that you do around your views on markets, the dollar milkshake theory, is this is more about emphasizing the timeline. And I had even shared a tweet prior to the weekend saying the same thing, because I just feel like that energy around this is it, like the piglet thing, right? It's like people need to let go of that a little bit, dive into some of these views and these potential outcomes and give them all probability and consideration, because they all potentially can happen. But there's, you know, the classic, you know, if is not when, or, you know, if is one thing, understanding when is a whole other. And it definitely feels like it's boiling to this point where everyone just thinks, you know, tomorrow's the end of the world. We get to laugh now a little bit about the de-dollarization component that we were kind of struggling through earlier this year, because, I mean, you couldn't turn a corner without reading or hearing about it. And, you know, almost to the T, it like signaled a bottom for the dollar, and you know, the dollar's been ripping higher since. But still, that narrative can't let go. We saw a couple articles this week talking about China doing some sort of, you know, digital yuan trade for oil, but it's a mystery who they traded it with or if it even happened. And at the same time, then you saw India rejecting a trade with Russia and yuan for oil. And so it's those same type of thing. Like, you can get so lost and caught up in your own personal view that or ideology that you've fallen in love with, that you feel like tomorrow is it's all going to come true. And I feel like that hurts people financially frequently. Now,
let me just say something about it really quickly. And it absolutely does. And listen, I'm not saying that this stuff isn't going to happen. And I don't think anybody should completely ignore these things. You absolutely should be paying attention. If ever there's been a time to pay attention, this is it. But I can promise you there were people in 2010, 2011, 2012 who felt exactly the way many people feel right now, that this feels different this time. This is different. This is just can't go on, right? And yet here we are 10, 12 years later, and it's still going on. So listen, I'm not saying maybe we wake up Monday morning and it's all over, right? But we may be having this conversation 10 years from now too. And, you know, you just don't know. And I think once you accept that you don't know, it makes things a lot easier.
Yes, I definitely concur with that. It also makes the learning process more enjoyable, because you're not actually constantly trying to find things that support your argument. You're actually approaching it very open-minded. And there's a lot more fun in that, because you're not pushing your bias on everything and getting offended when something disagrees with your view. It does make the learning more enjoyable. And it's probably the only way you can actually survive on Twitter, because otherwise people will make you want to pull your hair out. Now, before we get to this, we're kind of teeing up for it with the direction of this conversation. But before we get to this thing with China and the thread that you wrote, you know, their bond holdings, de-dollarization, all that kind of packaged into one thing, I do want to, because I do think this bond market bloodbath we've been going through is very relevant to what you're going to talk about. But hitting 5% this week, at least from a talking point, was relevant in that it brings back the yield curve as a recession indicator. And everyone was all about, you know, recession being right around the corner, and the Fed can't hike without causing a crash. Look at the yield curve. Look how inverted it is. And then once that didn't transpire as quickly as they thought, then everybody fell back on the, oh yeah, well, there's a lag. But no one was predicting 18 months or 12 months out from the inversion. Everyone was like, inversion means recession. Here it comes. It's going to be the end of the world. So now the whole thing is, no. It's not the inversion. It's once it starts to steepen after inversion. But no one actually talks about why. What are your thoughts on why that ultimately starts to act as the Rubicon through which recession tends to be much closer? You know, a inversion might take 12 to 18 months. Once it starts to steepen, maybe it's 6 to 8.
Well, I think part of it is that most borrowing, when you go and you take a loan, most people aren't borrowing at 1 month variable rates. You may get a variable rate, but it's often priced off of a 5-year rate or a 10-year rate or whatever it is. And so while short rates going higher definitely has an impact on, refinancings that are happening, it impacts it even more once those long rates starting going higher, because a lot of loans are priced off of either the 10-year treasury or some kind of a longer term fixed income index. And the 10-year U.S. Treasury is the standard security yield off of which everything else in the world is priced off of. And we don't have time to get into the whole risk-free thing again. We've talked about that before. The 10-year U.S. Treasury is considered the risk-free rate. So just let's not get into that whole conversation right now. Just accept that that's it. And the fact that it is now rising, and it, you know, the front end started rising 18 months ago, but it's really just this year or late, you know, in the last 9 months where the long end, the 10-year and even the 30-year have started to rise and catch up with the front end. And so the yield curve has gone from massively inverted to still inverted, but very quickly flattening. That's indicating that maybe recession isn't quite here, but it's also indicating why, now that the front end hikes are starting to show up in the economy, from the lag effect, and now all of these pricings on the 10-year, or all of these new refinancings that are taking place and are pegged off of the 10-year, are going to be higher as well. I think that's what brings the inevitable recession on. We talked about this many times earlier this year. I don't know if we've talked about it recently, but we've talked about how higher rates actually somewhat act as a stimulus until you hit the wall. So if you use the racing car analogy, right? It's like you're going through the turn, and rather than putting on the brake, you actually put on the gas, right? And so those rate hikes actually help accelerate the car, and until you hit the wall, you're actually going to be speeding up. And I kind of feel like that's the same thing with these long ends. As the long end rises, you know, people are getting paid more on the bonds they buy. The government's spending more money, and it's helping to speed up the car, but it will eventually hit that wall. And, you know, in which turn it hits the wall, I'm not smart enough to know. I just know eventually we'll hit it.
Well, and from a tightening/lag component, do you think the Fed at this point is happy to see the long end finally catching up, because they can only move, in theory, the front end with the overnight lending rate, but probably, I would think, from the get-go, they would want to tighten the long end just as much. How do you think they're internally viewing or reacting to the steepening of the long end?
Yeah, so this has been kind of, I've talked about this quite a bit over the last year, and this has been kind of an area of debate as well, and that is that, you know, first of all, the Fed sets the front end. They don't set the long end. And so when people say, you know, the Fed doesn't control the long end, they're right. The Fed doesn't control, but they definitely can influence it. And if you think the Fed wanted to take front end rates to 5 or 6%, but they wanted long end rates to stay at 1, that would be a massively inverted yield curve. And that would not only be signaling a recession, because remember, when this started out, the Fed, they are purposely trying to slow the economy. And they may even be willing to accept a recession to do it, because they think that is how you get inflation under control. But what they don't want is an economic global meltdown. But if you have the front end at 1% and the long end at 0, and you have a massively, and that is signaling meltdown. That is not signaling, you know, that's certainly not signaling a soft landing, and it's not signaling a recession. That's signaling absolute chaos and disaster. So they don't want a massively inverted yield curve. I don't think that they mind that it's inverted, but they don't want it massively inverted. The other reason that they raise, so that part of the reason they raise rates is to make borrowing more expensive. Well, we just talked about how there's not that much borrowing that takes place on the front end. Most of the borrowing takes place further out the curve. And so they want that further out the curve to rise, because that's what constricts the extension of credit. If you constrict the extension of credit, you slow growth, and then you get inflation under control. But the other thing, and I think we touched on this last week, and that most people don't think about this, but the other reason that the Fed wants interest rates to go higher, especially on the 5-year, 10-year, you know, a longer term, is because that is where the majority of bonds sit. Other than the newly issued ones at, you know, T-bills that have been massively issued, there's a lot of bonds out there, even corporate bonds, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20-year maturities. as interest rates rise, especially the longer end rises, those bonds fall in price. The reason they want those bonds to fall in price is that those bonds, especially treasuries, are the biggest source of collateral in the world off of which new loans can be made. Remember, this whole system is a debt-based system. You use collateral off of which to make new loans, and in those new loans, new money is created. But they're trying to reduce that. They're trying to reduce the money being created because they're trying to get inflation under control. So as they get the long end to come up, those long bonds fall in price. And as those long bonds fall in price, that means there can't be as much new money levered off of top of that collateral. So, and again, Powell, he didn't come out and say it this way, but he kind of talked about it in his speech this week. And, you know, that, so this is a very long way of answering your questions. I don't think that they're upset that the long end is rising. Now, I don't think they want the long end to go from 2% to 10% in a month. That wouldn't be good either. That would be a signal that, you know, again, disaster's on the way. But, you know, the fact that interest rates have been rising and the Fed has been a big part of that, I mean, I think that's what they want. So, I until the system crashes, I think they're very happy with what's going on.
I like the perspective that the inverted yield curve is basically the market disagreeing with Fed policy. So if the Fed is setting short-term rates and it's set at 4% and you have long duration bonds with yields lower than that, the market's basically saying, hey, we disagree with the direction you're taking things and we think this is how money should be priced. So another way of looking at this, which is potentially interesting for a lot of the hard landing recession hawkers, is this is potentially the market suddenly, you know, the flatter you get, the market's agreeing with Fed policy and saying,
that's
okay,
absolutely
maybe you,
right.
Yeah, maybe you do have this priced right.
Yeah, so I mean, again, so for 18 months, the market was fighting the Fed. Again, don't fight the Fed, but they were fighting the Fed. They didn't think long rates would go higher. Well, you know what? They're higher. You lost.
So let's talk about the other big loser, China. No, well, we will.
I thought you were going to talk about me.
No. We haven't put you on that show yet. I mean, I think you're doing okay in Puerto Rico. I don't know if you're qualified for the biggest loser, but the China situation when it comes to the world's second largest economy, trying to look through that veil and understand what they're actually doing. Number one, as a government policy stance, as well as just economically, what's going on there is always tricky. But one of the things that, again, goes along with so much of what we talk about and so much of what, you know, you're engaged with as far as debate is the de-dollarization topic. And China being one of the largest holders of treasury bonds, it's all eyes are on them in terms of how are they managing that balance sheet. And there's been a chart that we've talked about multiple times that has shown this rapid decline in what apparently is China's bond holdings. What we've argued is that it's actually the net asset value. And back to the point that you just made is as rates rise, the price on especially earlier minted bonds that are at lower yields, the price on those bonds are going to drop. And in this case, given how quick rates have risen or how high they have risen, the price on those bonds have dropped dramatically. And so your point was that this chart was showing net asset value, not the aggregate holdings that China has that they're dumping, but the fact that what they do hold is actually dumping in price. Therefore, they're losing dollars. Now, you've done some research on that. You wrote a whole thread on that. So please tell us what you've learned, tell us what you're still unsure about, and give us a TLDR on that thread.
Okay, so let me set it up where how this all started. And I'll tell you, especially for anybody who hasn't followed this story, I think it's important to understand this. And then the other thing I'll just say is, listen, you know, I am obviously a fairly opinionated person. But in my defense, I don't think you can manage money, especially money for other people, if you don't have an opinion. So it kind of goes with the territory. But the most important thing about having an opinion is that if and when you're wrong, you change your mind and you move on and you take that into account. And so in all of my debates and all of my presentations and all of my, you know, Twitter spats, it's really all about learning. It's not all about learning. A lot of it's just fun, right? But the point in having those conversations is that sometimes you uncover these new little gems, or you think about something in a different way than you ever have before. And I'm happy to, you know, get into these debates without taking it personally. Like, none of this stuff's ever personal. It's just, I'm trying to figure things out and I'm trying to share what I learned along the way. So earlier this year, it was in the midst of all the de-dollarization stuff. Let's say it was April, May timeframe. There was these charts going around, and I think the first one I ever commented on was one about Saudi Arabia, but they were going around about Saudi Arabia. They were going around about China. They were going around about the world just in general. And they were showing the fall in treasury holdings by Saudi Arabia and China. And it was used as evidence of de-dollarization and that they were dumping treasuries. And these were like 10-year charts, right? And the point I made at the time was these charts are not representative of U.S. Treasury sales. It's not that sales aren't in there, but those charts represent the net asset value of those countries' holdings at the end of the month, current market value at the date that those reports are generated. And that, even today, is 100% accurate. So you can't just look at these 5 and 10 year charts and say, this is China dumping treasuries, because that chart would show China going from like 1.2 trillion to 850 billion. So, you know, 25% of their holdings were sold over the last 3 years. China did not sell 25% of their holdings over the last 3 years. And if they did, and if that chart is actually showing only sales, then that means that their holdings are actually worth less than 850 billion because treasury prices have dropped dramatically over the last 2 or 3 years. So perhaps their holdings would then be 20 or 30% lower than what's represented on those graphs. And I would explain to people, these graphs are net asset value. It accounts for sales and fluctuations in value. And because fluctuations in value have dropped so much, those graphs are largely showing a drop in valuation and not sales. So this, you know, that's where this all started. And this has gone on for 2 or 3 months. And then in the last week, another one came out, and an updated came out, and it shows that China had sold, I think, $16 billion in bonds in August. And again, I made the comment that maybe they sold $16 billion, but these are net asset values. You also have to consider, you know, the change in valuation. And that's when somebody sent me a chart that showed sales, and it was titled as sales. So that's when I went back to the Treasury International Capital Department at the U.S. Treasury, and I went through the footnotes and I read everything, and there was a change input in February where they started reporting a little bit differently, and they started reporting sales, but then they also say that it's still net asset value at the end of the month. So they have a column for net asset value at the end of the month, they have a column for sales, and they have a column for change in valuation. Well, that column for change in valuation is blank. Nobody fills it out. And that's another thing. I'll tell you how these charts even get to be charts in the first place. And if you look at the net sales since February, when they put this new way of doing it in place, it does show about $40 billion in sales. And the interesting thing is, from, you know, February until August, which is the latest these treasury sales are up, that same holdings page, that same chart shows about $40 billion of prices coming down. But something is wrong with this, because treasury prices have come down over that time period as well. So if the portion of the chart from February until now is just showing sales, but the previous part didn't, then something is also still wrong with the portion from February to now. So I had 3 conversations with the Treasury Department about this. And at the end of the day, they stand by their work, but they are also saying this is a new process. They literally admitted that the way people fill these forms out, they may be filling them out wrong. They literally admitted that people may be saying they are sales when in fact it's a change in valuation. And they said, when we do more testing on it, we may have to go back and restate some of these things. Now, when I found this out, I went on Twitter and I said, hey, these are absolutely confirmed. I have it in writing and three conversations that these are net asset value charts. But I'm the first to admit that I didn't realize this change happened in February. And based on that, it shows that there has been these sales since February. But something is still not right. And as I continue to dig into this, I'll let you know what happens. But in the meantime, if I misspoke or if I told you wrong or if you hurt or what, I'm sorry. I should have known about this change and I didn't. And I think that's how everybody should act. I think when you discover new information, you should take that into account and you should share it with others. And that's what I've done. And I will continue to do it. But I will also say there has been what cracked me up the most was I was discussing with some people both in person and then over Twitter and over email last night, this very issue. And they were adamant that these were treasury sales. And maybe they were, but I literally spoke to the people who create these charts and they said they're not 100% sure. But what I found the most funny about it, John, was like every day for I don't know how many years now, I get people telling me that the US government is failing. They're a bunch of morons. They can't do absolutely anything right. And then when I finally come out and say, hey, I don't trust all of this data that these are putting out, those same people who tell me the government can't do anything right are saying, these charts are 100% correct. So anyway, that's where it's at. But I would say, if anybody shows you a holdings chart of Saudi Arabia or China or Japan or anybody, and they tell you that that is 100% representative of treasury sales, it is complete bullshit. It is not 100%. If they are referencing this tick data that shows their holdings and they're using this chart as their evidence of sales, they are not telling the whole truth. Sales may be a part of it, but valuation change is part of it as well. So I'm going to continue to dig into this. I'll share what I learn when I learn, but that is kind of what's happened. But here's the other thing. If I am completely wrong and all of these charts show sales, that would actually bolster my opinion. That would actually bolster my whole dollar milkshake theory. I have said for years that China is short of dollars. They don't have as many dollars as everybody thinks they have, and they are going to need more of them to kind of help get through the coming crisis than they have to do it. But I have been saying they have not been selling treasuries at the rate that these charts indicate in order to do that. But if those charts do, in fact, indicate that China sold 25% of their treasuries in the last 3 years, that bolsters my whole dollar milkshake theory even more. So at the end of the day, I just want to know the truth. I don't really care. It doesn't really change my thesis one way or the other. If I ever do get information that changes my thesis, I'll come on here, I'll raise my hand, I'll say, hey, everybody, I got a new information. We got to change. But so far, it continues to play out. So I have not seen the need to change yet. But as I continue to research this and as I continue to learn, I'll share it here and we'll just have to see how it goes.
Well, I'm going to try to TLDR your TLDR. So, you know, this Brent's become the investigative journalist. You know, this is serious when you drop a hard y'all in there. I knew this is going to be a real personal talk. But so look, trying to kind of encapsulate, because I've seen the thread, I've seen the charts, I've had this conversation with you multiple times, we've had similar ones here, but to summarize, at least if you can try to visualize in your head what Brent's talking about, let's say you have $100 and you buy $100 worth of bonds, let's say 5 years ago, and the value of that has declined, let's keep the math simple and say 20%. Okay, so you could then say, if I don't sell any of it, that the $100 I spent is now only worth technically $80. But what's going on here is we're seeing charts that aren't necessarily clear what they're indicating, in that if the price decline was not even a factor. Now let's look at it differently and say I have $100 worth of bonds. Let's say at the time every bond was a dollar, so I have 100 bonds. Well, if I sold, let's make the numbers a little different, let's say 30% of my holdings, so now I only have 70 bonds. Well, if those 70 bonds are no longer worth a dollar, I don't have $70 worth of bonds, because there's also a 20% decline in price. So what you're ultimately saying is that this information is, even here in the US, when we're trying to aggregate this data. It's as opaque as the stuff that we criticize China for putting together, but it's not just one or the other, depending on how, you know, you want to interpret this. If you think it's just the bonds being sold and you're trying to make a point that, look, this is de-dollarization because China is dumping bonds, well, then that asset value of what they're still holding is significantly less, because if they sold 30% and bonds are down 20%, they have that much less dollars, which kind of goes into a whole point that you made there at the end, that you think their dollar holdings in terms of net asset value or the nominal amount of dollars that they have could cause real problems for the global economy, the whole dollar milkshake theory, which, again, if you're not familiar with, yep, Start Here playlist on the top of our YouTube channel. And then ultimately this chart, for a long time you've been arguing, is really just the decline in net asset value, because recently bond prices have fallen so much because interest rates have gone up. And through this research that you've done, it's an unsure, we don't know, potential combination of both. And so it still goes back to the point that you're making is, hey, I got some of this wrong because there is some sort of blend here, but it is not what everyone who wants to make this point about de-dollarization thinks it is, which is it's just the selling off of the total bond holdings. And if that was true, the chart would look a hell of a lot worse because the ultimate value of those bonds has declined.
That's absolutely right. And there's also been a couple people who have made the claim that when they show these charts, that they're actually charting the nominal value of the bonds, meaning the face value of the bond that they purchased, and it's not showing current market value. And I can give you 100% guarantee, I don't care what the charts are labeled, if you see this chart and it's labeled as tick data, the Treasury International Capital Department created this, and that's the source of their data, and they have it says nominal value or face value on the chart, the chart is mislabeled. Again, these are current market values at the time they were created. That is definite.
You got that, y'all? All right. So I think that'll do it for us here on the full length episode of Milkshakes Markets Madness. We hope you enjoyed our banter here about all the crazy things that are going on in the markets. You know, it was definitely a hat tip to you, Brent, before going into the fourth quarter. It was definitely something you said, that this is a season of volatility. We've had plenty of that. Every week feels like we're just trying to catch our breath. There hasn't been any major moves just yet, but there definitely seems like chess pieces are being placed and something could pop at any moment. For now, hopefully you got some value from, you know, our takes on what's been going on recently, particularly this last week. And we look forward to your feedback in the comments. Please share the show with anyone you think will enjoy it. If you want to follow Brent on Twitter and check out that long thread he put together and dive into that topic a little bit more, you can find him there at Santiago AU Fund. You can find me right along with him on Twitter at John Kutzmita. You can follow the show on YouTube and on Twitter, The Milkshakes Pod. We also have milkshakespod.com, where there's blog posts there that have links to all the videos and some other stuff that we're slowly developing. So, Brent, any last words before we sign off on this full length?
No, I think this is going to be another crazy week. You know, we've been saying this for the last 3 weeks, and each week has been it's actually been pretty exciting. It's been fun. I actually like it when markets are more volatile than when they're not. And so, you know, we said that as we got into the end of the third quarter, fourth quarter, things were going to get interesting, and we're kind of right in the heart of it now. So, you know, buckle up and pay attention, because I don't know what's going to happen, but I don't think it's going to be boring.
Well, we hope you guys join us for our Monday peak of the week, where we'll look at some of the things on the economic calendar, maybe throw out some predictions like Brent did last week about Tesla. So look for that video coming out Monday morning. By the time you see this, it'll be Sunday evening, and we hope you had a wonderful weekend. We'll talk to you guys all very soon. This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.